Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
And the Vietnam War still haunts public policy today. With 60 Minutes apologizing on air last night for the recent flawed Benghazi report, some attention is also now being focused on the correspondent who reported the story and issued the on-air apology, foreign correspondent Laura Logan, who has spent a great deal of time on the front lines, especially in Afghanistan. She also gave a controversial speech in October as the keynote speaker at the annual luncheon of an investigative journalism organization called the Better Government Association. Logan referenced Vietnam in arguing against the planned U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan.
To think that there's any similarity between this and Vietnam is ridiculous. The Viet Cong didn't care what you did when you went back to America. The Viet Cong weren't fighting for an Islamic caliphate. The Viet Cong didn't have a global struggle. And it's amazing to me that we constantly ignore what Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and Haqqani and all these groups tell us every day in their own newspapers, in their own statements. They share something. They share an idea. Al-Qaeda is not an organization. You don't have to have a card, a membership card or a badge or something that we recognize in our society, something that the FBI can say, okay, I know what that is. I'm going to hold you responsible for what you did in Libya, and we're going to put you on trial in America. This is terrorism. It's a completely and utterly different fight from anything we have faced in our history. And that's why we chose to do this story. Because what's the one thing about Afghanistan that's going to come home to haunt us? What we have done there for the last 11 years, our role in the Middle East, our role across the world, our way of life is under attack. And if you think that's government propaganda, if you think that's nonsense, if you think that's warmongering, you're not listening to what the people who are fighting you say about this fight.
CBS correspondent Laura Logan in a speech in October. On tomorrow's show, we will look more closely at the flawed 60 Minutes report on Benghazi and the charges now surfacing that a conservative political bias may have caused the error. With us now, mostly to talk about the stalled peace talks with Iran, is New York Times chief Washington correspondent David Sanger, also author of the book Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. Hi, David. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be with you, Brian.
And I thought, given all that you've written about that's related to the clip we just heard, being that people are starting to circulate clips like that from Laura Logan's speech in October, just for some context, she took a sort of the position that, you know, maybe John McCain, Lindsey Graham, people like that are taking, that the Taliban in Afghanistan want to come after us here after we leave, that there's really no difference between the Afghanistan war for control of that country and the global al-Qaeda war that 9/11 was a part of. And in that respect, any analogy with Vietnam falls apart. Do you think the facts bear that out?
Well, I think you've got to separate out, and the only part of her speech I've heard is the part that you've played on the clip. I think you have to separate out two different issues that she raises. One that would put her, I think, probably in the camp of the analysis that President Obama did about Afghanistan in 2009, and then a second one which gets to the question of whether or not you're fighting a global al-Qaeda caliphate, as to use the word she discussed, or whether you're fighting a much more element-by-element terrorist war. So in 2009, when President Obama first did the review of the Afghan and Pakistan strategy, and it's something I describe it at great length in a couple of chapters in Confront and Conceal, he was sort of haunted by all of these historians from the Johnson era who he had dinner with, who said to him, look, Afghanistan can be your Vietnam. And what they meant was, don't escalate there. And the conclusion he came to was that Afghanistan was not like Vietnam. And if you're looking for his conclusions on this, he described it in his speech at West Point on December 1st, 2009, when he announced the surge. And he said, look, a lot of people have said that Afghanistan is like Vietnam. I don't believe it is. And the reason I don't believe it is that no one we were fighting in Vietnam had the reach to get to the United States. And in Afghanistan, and going after al-Qaeda in particular, they do. Now, that part would agree with her. The second part of her statement, though, suggested that because we were in Afghanistan, we've been having these terror attacks. Well, the first big terror attack that started all this was September 11, 2001, and we weren't in Afghanistan at that time. So,
well, she didn't say, I mean, my understanding of that clip was not that she said we're being attacked because we're in Afghanistan. I heard it as more of a plea not to withdraw precipitously because we haven't won yet, and al-Qaeda still has enough of a base there to come and get us.
Right. And the difficulty with this argument is that al-Qaeda has had for years now a very, very tiny presence, some people would say less than 100 people, in Afghanistan. That doesn't mean they wouldn't go back in once the United States and its allies completely left. But you have seen al-Qaeda morph into different locations, to Yemen. We've seen them in Africa. And most of the plots, including if you think about, say, the shoe bomber plot or the Times Square plot, were hatched in places outside of Afghanistan. So she's right in that there's a continuing struggle there. The question is whether continuing a significant troop presence in Afghanistan helps you with that or not.
And whether it's a quagmire or not, which is another piece of comparison that people use to analogize Vietnam and Afghanistan. You fight, you never actually win, and you never make the country that much more, America, that much more safer than 3 weeks ago.
Right, and that was the theory under which President Obama, having done the surge, then announced that we will be completely out by 2014, and or if not completely out, that they will negotiate just a very minimal American presence, which would probably be at most 5,000 or 6,000 troops who would mostly be on their bases, and partly that would be aimed at keeping an eye on Pakistan as well. Now, that doesn't sound like an American quagmire, but it does sound like it raises the question. So after 12 years, by that time 13 years in Afghanistan, what of a lasting nature of change have we brought to Afghanistan? And I think that's going to be as difficult to find as the lasting nature of change that we brought in the 1950s when we took Afghanistan on as a big development case.
All right. We'll talk more on tomorrow's show about CBS's flawed Benghazi report and apology on 60 Minutes last night and policy ripples from that. But let's move on with David Sanger from the war the president is trying to disentangle us from to the one he's trying not to start with Iran. Talks on a partial nuclear deal in exchange for a partial lifting of sanctions did not come to fruition over the weekend, as it was reported they might, but neither did the talks break down. Another round is scheduled next week. So, David, what was the big sticking point?
Well, there were two. One was with the French, and the other was with the Iranians. So the French concern is that this interim deal, and remember what this deal was about freezing Iran's current activity so that you could negotiate the bigger deal that ultimately would lead to, one would hope, a dismantlement of a number of their facilities so that you could increase the amount of time it would take them if they ever decided to race for a bomb. That's what these negotiations are really about. And the French concern was that this interim deal could just settle in as the final deal. And if that's the case, Iran would not have dismantled a single centrifuge or been set back any and could restart as they restarted 10 years ago when there was a similar freeze in place when the man who is now the president of the country, President Rouhani, was the nuclear negotiator. That was the French concern. The Iranian concern was a little bit different. It was the flip side of it. It was that this interim deal didn't get them enough sanctions relief up front that they could go home and sell it. Because, of course, the big sanctions relief, which is allowing Iran to once again sell freely in the oil market, wouldn't come until the final deal was together.
So the French thought we were giving away too much and the Iranians thought we weren't giving away enough?
That's called a negotiation, Brian.
I guess so. And let me play a couple of clips from the Sunday morning talk shows, because the political context includes, as you know, very active lobbying by opponents of any such deal. So here is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on CBS Face the Nation yesterday.
Iran should take away its centrifuges, should take away its plutonium, should dismantle its plutonium heavy water reactors. Nora, how many centrifuges are dismantled in this agreement? Do you know?
Tell me.
Question?
Yes.
Zero. Not one. Zero. In other words, Iran maintains all its capabilities. It built itself up in the face of international decisions and resolutions. It defied them, went right up to very close to the top, and now it stays there. It doesn't bring down, dismantle one centrifuge. It continues to have the mountains of material from which they can take into the centrifuges and make atomic bombs. All they're doing is taking a little material that they've enriched to a higher degree and bringing it back. That's nothing.
Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu with Nora O'Donnell hosting Face the Nation on CBS yesterday. We're going to play Secretary Kerry's response to that idea. But can you fact check what we just heard from Netanyahu?
Sure.
David Sanger?
Absolutely. So the facts that Prime Minister Netanyahu laid out are correct. This interim deal does not force Iran to dismantle any centrifuges or its plutonium reactor or any of its other major facilities, nor was it intended to. It was intended to buy some space for negotiations for that deal by stopping the Iranian production now so that if the talks drag on, the Iranians aren't building up a capability while the talks happen, okay, which was the big risk that the Obama administration and many of the Europeans have been concerned about. So if Prime Minister Netanyahu was critiquing this as and critiquing the final deal, then he'd have, you know, intellectually a pretty solid case that this would freeze Iran in a position where it could produce enough fuel for a bomb in a few months. What you're going to hear from Secretary Kerry, I suspect, I don't know what clip you've picked, but just reading his public comments in recent times, is he's saying, whoa, slow down. This isn't the final deal. This is just to be able to give us space to get the real negotiations going.
And in exactly that context, here's a little bit of what he said on NBC's Meet the Press.
If, as their act of good faith, they freeze their program and allow us absolutely unprecedented access to inspection and do other things, I'm not going to go into the list, but if they do the things that we believe is necessary so that we can guarantee we know what is happening and we can move it back while we negotiate the end game, it seems to me you've got to do something that indicates your good faith.
So Iran's good faith, the United States' act of good faith, is it clear what they are?
Well, you know, negotiations rarely happen all in one big swoop. And so the idea here was get the Iranians to freeze their activity, show them that the United States is willing to loosen up on some small element of the sanctions, and therefore, in other words, provide both sides some tantalizing appetizer and say, now we need to move on to the main meal.
And what would the main meal be?
Here's what the main meal would be. The main meal would be that Iran began to dismantle, rolled back much of the progress that they've made during the Obama administration, and that in return, the Obama administration would lift many of the sanctions that have gone into effect since the president came into office in January 2009. And in fact, the Iranians have made big progress in their nuclear program and their capability since 2009. When President Obama came in, they had roughly 2,000 kilograms of nuclear fuel. That would be enough with further enrichment to make maybe one little more weapons. Now they have 9,000 kilograms. They had a few thousand centrifuges in 2009. Now they have 18,000. They weren't close to being able to produce have a plutonium reactor get into operation in 2009. Now they're about a year away. So they've made a lot of progress, but they've also suffered a lot more because the sanctions have been ratcheted up. And the question is, can you get both sides to roll back? That's the main deal.
I want to take a couple of phone calls. People are calling in to react to the Lara Logan clip that compared Vietnam to Afghanistan and said there's really no comparison. Bill in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I was just with her clip, I guess the thing, her talking about how they're all out to destroy the American way of life was sort of felt like fear-mongering to me. And on, you know, Veterans Day, we forget sort of the real cause. With Vietnam, we were supposedly fighting communism, and even McNamara, you know, at the end of the war said it was a mistake and that we didn't really understand Vietnam culture. And with Afghanistan, it's our foreign policy. It's not the American culture. They don't really want to take away our freedom. It's our foreign policy. Even, you know, Osama bin Laden said it was giving weapons to Saudi Arabia, our relationship with Israel. They give very specific causes how we're supplying the world with arms and helping support dictators. And that's why people hate us. And we need to look more at these causes instead of this fear-mongering to get America scared that, oh, it's our culture. They're jealous of our freedom. So that was my main point. I'll take any thoughts off air.
Bill, thank you for that. And, you know, I was surprised to hear that from a CBS News correspondent. David, this is something that, you know, Bush and Cheney and others have said all along since 9/11. And I think it's complicated that there are certain people who are true believers in the al-Qaeda cause who really do just hate our way of life. They hate democracy. They want to impose a caliphate all over the world, all of that kind of stuff. And there are many other people who get involved in what we call terrorism because they do have political grievances. I think it's a complicated thing to unpack, actually.
It is. And, you know, I don't know why one would expect that people who oppose the United States throughout the world and throughout the Muslim world would all have the same set of grievances any more than you would expect that politicians in the United States, as they talk about the rest of the world, would have the same set of complaints about our operations in the world or the way the world deals with us. So, you know, you go to Egypt and people ask you a lot about Guantanamo. I was struck when I was there about a year and a half ago, about the number of people who asked me about why Guantanamo Bay was still open, because you wouldn't think that that was a major issue for the Egyptians. It turned out to be. Obviously, you go to the Palestinian territories, their concern there is obvious. You go to Pakistan and you hear about the drones. And then you go to other parts of the Arabic world and you hear about what your caller described. So I'm not sure that everybody is on the same page here. And I think that's part of the difficulty in trying to assess what al-Qaeda's intentions are.
All right. We're going to turn the page in just a second here.
Let me add just one other thing. And obviously, many people who said that wouldn't sign up to al-Qaeda ideology and wouldn't support strikes on the United States, even if they deeply disagree with our foreign policy.
Right. I'm glad you added that. Coming up in a minute, we're going to talk about how to help the victims of Typhoon Haiyan. Of course, the central Philippines suffered a storm surge much higher than from Sandy, can you imagine? And it's very difficult to get information out of there. So I'm sure a lot of you, whether you're from the Filipino-American community or just, you know, anybody around here who's like, oh, my God, how could such an even worse thing than Sandy happen and what can we do to help? We'll want to hear our guests from CARE International coming up. But David Sanger from the New York Times, just tell us what happens next with these Iran talks, because this wasn't a breakdown of talks. This was like we're not there yet, right?
That's right. So today the Iranians and the International Atomic Energy Agency announced what kind of inspections the IAEA would be allowed to do going forward. And I thought what was notable there is that while they're allowing some expanded access to some sites, the big questions all are not mentioned in that statement. And those are, would Iran explain the evidence that it has worked on an actual weapon as opposed to just on the fuel, of which there's been a lot of evidence that has leaked out of Iran, and the Iranians say it's all false, and the Americans and Europeans say, no, this is evidence that there is a secret bomb program. So they got to get to the bottom of that. Next week, in about 10 days, they resume the negotiations that broke off yesterday. And the question is, in that interim time, do they close up their differences, or do those who oppose an agreement in Iran, and maybe even here in the United States, in Israel and elsewhere, use that time to drive a bigger wedge? So it's very hard to tell which way this one's going to go. You could imagine pressure on President Obama not to sign the deal that he would have been willing to sign over the weekend. You can imagine pressure on the Iranians. The same thing.
David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent for The New York Times and author of Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. David, thank you so much.
Thank you. Great to be with you, Mark.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. How to Help the Victims of Typhoon Haiyan, next.